Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, new challenges for Catholic peace building. We hear from men and women working at the front lines of conflict resolution and reconciliation in countries around the world. And Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, former Archbishop of Westminster, continues his reflections on the 50th anniversary of Vatican II. How far has the Church come in terms of ecumenical relations and the real need for collegiality between the Holy See and the local bishops' conferences? How can Catholic peace networks and individual activists become more effective in overcoming conflict and sowing seeds of reconciliation amongst divided communities? That was the key challenge to emerge this week during a two-day seminar jointly organised by the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council and Caritas Internationalis. The meeting, marking the upcoming 50th anniversary of Pope John XXIII's landmark encyclical Pacem in Terris, brought together men and women from some of the world's worst conflict zones to share best practices and discuss ways of developing broader partnerships across all sectors of society. Cardinal Peter Turkson from Ghana is president of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council.
We had a chance to look at human rights issues, human dignity as suggested by the encyclical, and how it impacts and provides a constitutes a challenge to peace building. We've had a chance to look at interreligious dialogue and its component contribution to peace building. We had a chance to identify who could be our partners in the peace building efforts around the world. But most importantly, as the theme and the topic says, Catholic peace building. And it is basically to identify and to try to define the specific contribution that our church, the Catholic Church, can contribute to peace building around the world.
The meeting entitled New Challenges for Catholic Peacebuilding began with the premise that the Catholic Church around the world is a powerful force for peace, justice and reconciliation, though too often its work remains unknown and underappreciated.
Of course, there are many different dimensions of the work for peace.
Marie Dennis is co-president of the International Catholic Peace Network, Pax Christi, and former director of the US-based Maryknoll Office for Global Concerns.
Yes, I do think that the Catholic Church is a powerful force for peace in the world, partly because the Church is present in so many places, where, in so many corners of the world where violence is a major problem, and is working at every level imaginable to promote peace. So the Church is present at a very grassroots level and all the way up through societies. In many places, the Church has both national and international access to decision makers. And I think that because of the many levels at which the Church is able to work, the peace work of the Church can be extremely effective. It's also true that Catholic theology has very deep gifts to bring to the work for peace. And so whether it is our sacrament of reconciliation or our deep belief in the intrinsic value of every human life, our deepest beliefs give us strong motivation to work for peace.
You've been particularly involved in the work at decision-making level, haven't you, in Washington, throughout the US. Tell us a little bit about the work that goes on here and how successful you think this top-level work, if you want to call it that, has been.
I think it's probably mixed. At a top level, I believe that the most important, there are two parts to our job when we're interacting with high-level decision-makers, whether they're in the United Nations or the U.S. government or in any other government or agency. One is to find ways to bring the experience of people who are the victims of war, of terrible violence, into the circles where decisions are being made. And the second is to reflect our values in that same process. So our ability to be successful in some ways depends on our ability to do those two things, to facilitate the voices of the victims of violence and to lift up the values that we hold very dear. Whether that's effective in political terms depends on the moment. I do believe that it is appreciated. Very often, both in my work for Mary Knoll and in my work with Pax Christi, very often we are told that voices that come into that level of decision-making debate without self-interest are very important. So I think that what we do is important and valued, whether it actually has an impact in shifting the world away from war and violent conflict, I'm not too sure.
Can you give me any examples of areas where you feel that your work, your efforts at reconciliation and bringing forth the voice of the victims, can you give me any examples where you really feel you have had some kind of objective success?
Probably one very specific example is from a few years ago, but current now because of the great attention that Kony 2012, that YouTube video got. Pax Christi, specifically Pax Christi, IKV Pax Christi Netherlands, was very instrumental in convincing the Lord's Resistance Army, Joseph Kony, to actually sit down for a series of almost successful peace talks with the government of Uganda. At times, that's the sort of work that we do that has a measure of success. In other places, for example, in Haiti, in Cité Soleil, in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, which was just a few years ago one of the most violent gang-infested parts of Haiti, a small, very effective Pax Christi group there has both started a Sports for Peace program that's extremely successful, and is also helping young people in that barrio, in that neighborhood, to learn about other ways of resolving conflict, to identify heroes from all parts of the world, people who have been effective in moving toward peace. Cité Soleil is quite a different place, I think, because of the work of this small Pax Christi group there. In other parts of the world, for example, in England, Pax Christi's work is much more at a parish level. Well, it's at a parish level and at an advocacy level with the British government. And Pax Christi there is known very well for the very consistent education about peace that it brings into parishes and into Catholic schools, and for its consistent voice for peace in relation to the British government. Those are successes because they change hearts and also because they open the possibilities for young people in terms of what the future might look like and how they might participate in the future.
Sowing small seeds for peace, developing deep roots for reconciliation, there were many analogies used to describe the patient and persistent work of building bridges across divided communities, which is a priority for the global Catholic aid and development network Caritas Internationalis. Michel Roy is Caritas Secretary General.
People need to know each other. They've been fighting. They've been invited to fight on ethnic or religious basis, which have been invented. They are not the real reasons why they were fighting. And so bringing people together to know each other, establish a relationship. This is very basic, but it proves very efficient. We have interesting insight on what is being done right now in Sri Lanka between Tamil Hindu villagers, and it's really grassroots, and Sinhalese Buddhist villagers coming together, getting to know each other and establishing a relationship, which is a friendship relationship. And I think this is, you know, in many other places, an option, because peace is not something which is imposed from the top. It's really something which comes from the grassroots upwards.
The continent of Asia was an important focus for the two-day Vatican meeting, which revealed many examples of excellent interfaith relations.
We always work with people of other faiths and traditions and beliefs, because that's the only way.
Mercedarian missionary Sister Philo Hirota is in charge of international relations for Japan's Catholic Council for Justice and Peace. She also works closely with the Manila-based Federation of Asian Bishops' Conferences.
For over 30 years, they identified what they call new way of being church, and that is through the living dialogue with the poor, with the cultures, and with the religions. And precisely because we are such a small minority, we have to be with others. And Asia is a vast continent where now, today, we have two-thirds of world population and majority are poor. So in order to be the church in Asia in a more relevant way, we have to have this living dialogue with the poor. And then also Asia is multicultures and multi-languages and everything, you know, and religions. So we believe that it is a very, very important way of being church in Asia. And of the different sort of levels of dialogue with other religions, we have had the very meaningful experience of interreligious dialogue for peace, justice, human rights and sustainable development. Precisely because you're such a small minority, it is absolutely important to be with others. And then also it makes it easy. And we are poor and we are small. And that is a blessing.
Can you give me some examples, perhaps, in your experience, where you've really seen this interfaith or intercultural work together on behalf of the poor bearing fruits?
Mm-hmm. Maybe I can tell you about, since I'm from Japan, and we have this Interfaith Asia Peace Initiative on Article 9. Article 9 is a Japanese constitution which renounces categorically any war and any potential war potential. So the Japan constitutionally cannot have any armed forces. And then we believe that this is a treasure, not only for Japan, but also for the world. And we have been organizing this interfaith network around Article 9. Article 9 espouses nonviolence as a way of being state. It's a constitutional nonviolence. And we have had three meetings so far. The last one was in Okinawa, in Japan, last year. And we have been meeting with other Christians, Buddhists, and Muslims from different countries of Asia. And then also in very close coordination with World Council of Churches and Pax Christi International.
This experience or this desire to remain a war-free nation, mm-hmm. of course, grows out of the terrible experience of the Second World War and the atomic attacks in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, doesn't it?
Yes, also, yes, but we always feel it's very important that, yes, we are very much against the nuclear weapons, but at the same time, we were aggressors. We colonized and invaded almost all the countries in Asia and part of Pacific. And so this is a pledge to peoples of Asia and Pacific region not to repeat this crime. So it is, yes, it's because of our war experience. Article 9 is sort of like a price that we paid for the crime we committed.
In India, too, the Catholic Church is a tiny minority which may seem little able to counteract the interfaith tensions that regularly flare in the central and northern parts of the country. But according to Capuchin Father Nithaya Sagayam, head of the Office of Human Development for the Federation of Asian Bishops' Conferences, the vital work of building partnerships helps to prevent such tensions from taking root.
Some countries are really living in difficult moments. Some are in democracy, and those countries who are apparently seems to be living in democracy, there are certainly a lot of issues that can erupt at any time. For example, India. India seems to be peaceful, but when we have got any small incident of violence, immediately it erupts into social violence, cultural violence, human rights violations, violations against women, violations against lower caste. So this kind of terrible violations take place. Therefore, we have to address both the things. One is how to build peace before we foresee any dangers. And second thing is, when we are in a particular situation like dangers, what should be our role? As the church, as the civil society.
Of course, the church in most of these Asian countries, and in India particularly, is a very tiny minority. How can you have an effective voice in this work of peace building?
The peace is actually, it's not a religion-based. Peace issue is a secular, social, cultural, civil, political, economic issues. It's connected to the people's everyday life. So if you address peace as a people's value, a social value, a cultural value, then we have got a mileage to go ahead. Oftentimes, we used to, the religions in general, tend to think of addressing peace as a religious value, as a value to be given to a particular groups of religious people or people who follow a particular religion. We had to come out of that boundary if you are really looking for objective social peace. What is in our hand is creating relationship, building a strong unit. Therefore, any opposition comes to break peace, we are together to respond immediately. But the tendency is, each religion, when they celebrate a religious festival, they are very closed up. Christians calling only bishops, priests, and their own people. Why don't we call a government leaders to come and say some words? In our, we are minority people, but we have elected some people. They are responsible to everybody, minority, majority. Let him speak in our Christmas message. Let a Muslim come and speak a Hindu festival. Let a Hindu go and celebrate a festival in the Ramzan. So this kind of religious get-togethers, religious mixing will be a very good contribution. And church has the duty. We have the message. The Bible starts with the message of peace on earth, peace to all people of goodwill. And the risen Christ, at the end also, he gives, peace I leave with you. And this peace based on human rights. The new name for peace is human rights building.
From Asia to Africa, Latin America and the Middle East, the meeting heard many examples of how Pope John XXIII's vision of peace in Pacem in Terris continues to inspire the work of peace builders today. Women and men, young and old, ordained and lay, the major challenges they face today are new kinds of social conflict, competition for scarce resources, exploitation or the use of rape as a weapon of war. While the political, social and economic contexts may have changed enormously over the past half century, the need for a prophetic voice on behalf of the poor and victims of violence remains as vital as ever before. And as Marie Dennis of Pax Christi reminded me at the close of the meeting, the work of peace and reconciliation must still always begin within the individual human heart, hers, yours and mine.
It starts with us in our own, the way we treat ourselves as human beings and temples of the Holy Spirit. It certainly affects how we are in our interpersonal relationships and close to home. But the work for peace is also a work of living as if we were at peace. Although we are far from that panacea, if you will, from the new creation where peace will abound, nevertheless, if we don't begin ourselves and in our families and in our local communities and in our neighborhoods and on, living as if we were at peace, we will never have the capacity to build the kind of complex peace that is needed in the world at this time. So what each of us does is critically important.
My thanks there to Marie Dennis, co-president of Pax Christi. And earlier you heard Capuchin Father Nitaya Sagayam, Mercedarian missionary Sister Philo Hirota, Cardinal Peter Turkson, president of the Pontifical Justice and Peace Council, and Michel Roy, secretary-general of Caritas Internationalis. As well as the half century since Pacem in Terris, the church later this year will be marking the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council by Pope John XXIII on October 11, 1962. That three-year landmark meeting of bishops, which set a course for the church in the modern world, will be celebrated in many ways in countries around the globe, in particular here in the Vatican, as bishops gather once again in October for a synod on the need for new evangelization to promote the gospel message half a century on from Vatican II. As a young assistant priest in Portsmouth, England, at the opening of the council, Father Cormac Murphy O'Connor has vivid memories of the excitement and expectations which accompanied the opening of the council, some of which he shared with us on last week's programme. In the second part of that interview, the now retired Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, told me about his concern for ecumenical relations, in particular the future of ARCIC, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, as well as the need for a real spirit of collegiality between the Holy See and local bishops around the world.
There is an ARCIC 3 now. I mean, I was co-chair of ARCIC 2. And the ARCIC 3, I think some of its discussions are really going to be endeavouring to see how the creative work of ARCIC 2 can be accepted by the churches. I think that's been the problem with ARCIC, that when the documents are published, you know, they're documents in the air. Well, if once they're accepted, then that makes a difference. But those documents in ARCIC 1 weren't totally accepted by the Holy See, nor indeed, and they haven't even been assessed fully, I don't think, by ARCIC 2, I mean, the documents of ARCIC 2, by the Anglican or the Catholic Church.
How do you get around that? What can you do?
I think that it's up to ARCIC, the members of ARCIC 3, to look at these documents again and see how they can be presented to both churches. I mean, particularly our last document of ARCIC 2, the Gift of Authority, which was an extraordinary document, really, in a sense an appeal to Anglicans and to Catholics to understand, to the Catholic Church, saying that while we have a focus of authority, clearly the Holy See, the Pope, but their point, well, how is that authority shared? And so they would counteract with that. Well, there's a way in which we have to look at that closely ourselves, and we've also got to realise how, I'm not just thinking of the papal authority, but how is the authority of the bishops shared in a creative way with priests and people? How, in other words, how does the bishop listen to the priests and people in his diocese? How does that reflect his own mind as he comes together, not only in leading his diocese, but also with the other bishops in a real collegiality with the Pope?
This is a key question, perhaps one of the key questions facing the Catholic Church today, isn't it? Do you think there's enough thinking going on around this at the moment here at the Holy See, but also back home?
I don't think there is, in a way. I mean, I'd say that it began with Pope Paul when he instituted the Synod of Bishops and hoped that that would bring about the kind of collegial sense with his own papal authority. I think it doesn't work as well as it might have done. And I think one's got to look, from the Rome's point of view, at more creative ways in which the particular prerogatives and authority of the Holy See, and especially, of course, of the Pope, can somehow be expressed collegially. I think it's got to be looked at always, and particularly at the present time.
A good time, this anniversary of the 50th anniversary of the Council, perhaps, to look back at this.
Yes, I'd say so. I mean, the most profound document was clearly the document on the Church. Now, that's a document full of new insights on the mystery of the Church. The Church is a mystery of Christ in his people, and how is that mystery expressed, lived, witness to.
Looking back at the question of ecumenism in Britain, but also elsewhere, there seems to be very much this two-track approach. There's the official approach that we've been talking about, the official commissions and documents, and then there's ecumenism of the theologians at parish level, grassroots, which seems to progress very much faster in some ways. The question, perhaps, in my mind is, how do you get these two levels? How do you get the grassroots ecumenism to filter up to the official level?
Well, I think I'd say that the grassroots ecumenism has already permeated up to official level, because bishops and priests lead in ecumenism. The people themselves, as it were, nourish those unities. But I used to say when I was a bishop to the priests, you must take, you know, always take the first step. Because if you meet with the other clergy, are active with them, then lots of things can be done. We can't do everything together with fellow Christians, that's obvious. But there are some things that we can do. And if we do those well, in terms of prayer, in terms of some services together, in terms of a particular need which we express together, in other words, active ecumenical cooperation in the towns and villages, the effect of these can be very great indeed. I remember again when I was bishop in Arundel and Brighton, we had ecumenical groups all during Lent, and at the end we all met together, about 3,000 or 4,000 people. Anglicans and Catholics, and Free Church as well, but mostly Catholics and Anglicans. And we prayed, and we sang, and, you know, people were so lifted by this. Something a lot of the older people never thought they'd live to see. It's that sort of thing that adds a little impetus to the search for a fuller communion.
One other question. We're shortly celebrating the Diamond Jubilee of the Queen, and I'm curious to know how you yourself are going to be perhaps involved in that, and more broadly celebrations within the Catholic community.
Yeah, everybody's quite excited in Britain and elsewhere. There's no doubt she's a very, very profound Christian, and it's very nice to think from the Catholic point of view that over the past years she's become much more understanding, as she, an Anglican, of the Catholic Church. She knew my predecessor quite well, and I've got to know her very well over the past 10, 12 years. And she knows and understands the Catholic Church much more now than she did when she was crowned Queen.
Although she had already visited the Vatican before that, hadn't she?
Oh, yes. I was there as a student. It must have been in 1951, I think, when she came with Prince Philip. She wasn't Queen, she was Princess Elizabeth. And, oh, my goodness, in the Vatican, everybody was dressed up to the hilt, guards, and she came in looking very beautiful in the black dress, and all of us here at the English College were allowed to go in, and we were told on no account were we to clap or cheer or do anything. This was against Vatican protocol. So she went in, and she met Pope Pius XII, and then she came out, and all of us there, when she came out, we said, blow, you know, all that. So we clapped and we cheered, and she was rather chuffed. And I met her afterwards, and she said she was quite terrified going in, you know, with all this. Because the first time as a young woman, you go into the Vatican, Buckingham Palace is all very well, but it doesn't compare with the Vatican.
She has, of course, been back many times since then as Queen, and then hosted Pope Benedict most recently.
That's right.
in the UK.
I think that made a lot of difference. Pope Benedict's visit, thank God, was very, very successful one. And in some ways it was fortunate that immediately on arrival, his first visit was to be greeted, if you like, by Queen Elizabeth, who spoke very warmly. And from then on, the visit went extremely well, both in Scotland and in England, and made quite a profound effect on the country. And some of the things that Pope Benedict said are being pondered still, particularly his speech in Westminster Hall to the politicians and others of how important faith and life, religion, is in the secular society. And any attempt to kind of bypass it or put it on the periphery of life is something that's not only wrong, it's quite dangerous.
My thanks there to Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, former Archbishop of Westminster. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.